Good morning. Whoever you are, wherever you have come from, and whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Elaine Yaley Bowen, and I am today's worship associate, and I am joined by our worship leader and a pulpit exchange from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Greater Canton. This is Deb Cheney, who is their commissioned lay leader. We would like to welcome also our guest musicians who are with us. JR and Ash Campbell will be performing with Hal a little bit later on. I also have a message from our minister who called me last evening with very heartfelt and special thanks to all of the work party volunteers yesterday, and they were many. There was an outdoor crew that was headed by our sexton, Deb Biggins, and they worked at digging out and leveling the area in the back for settling in the new shed. The helpers included Lee Brooker, Dan Hannon, John Braverone, and Rylan Wassum. Now, the inside crew emptied out the very cluttered storage area behind and next to the kitchen to make room for the new tables and chairs. There is also an article in your thread from the web about this. But this group included the hard work of Deb Biggins and Meg Milko, Mary Beth Hannon, our church administrator, Marion Yeagler, Saunas Parsons, Michelle Boris, Logan Boris, Amber Strock, and the Reverend Melissa Carvel-Zemer. And she sends her great thanks for all who helped with that. I light the chalice this morning with these words of Adela Rogers St. John's. Joy seems to me to be a step beyond happiness. Happiness is a sort of atmosphere you can live in sometimes when you're lucky. Joy is a light that fills you with hope and faith and love. Sunset this Wednesday until sunset on Thursday, April 19th. It's called Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. It is the 27th day of the Hebrew month of Nisan. It is commemorated in Israel with a 10 a.m. time of silence, prayer, and reflection. It was not the end of the Holocaust, but it does mark the uprising of the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto on April 19th, 1943, 69 years ago. Elie Wiesel, who is a renowned author and survivor of the Holocaust, says in his landmark book, Night, "Sometimes I am asked if I know the response to Auschwitz. I answer that not only do I not know it, but that I don't even know if a tragedy of this magnitude has a response. What I do know is that there is response in responsibility. When we speak of this era of evil and darkness, so close and yet so distant, responsibility is the key word." He speaks of himself in the third person. The witness has forced himself to testify for the youth of today, for the children who will be born tomorrow. He does not want his past to become their future. Our responsibility to remember is to not let it occur again, anywhere, to anyone. Shalom. Come, let us bear witness. Come, let us worship together.
The Helping Hand.
Please join me now in the spirit of prayer. Great One, great Spirit of peace and of love, as we prepare remembrance for those who so unjustly perished so many years ago in the Shoah, the Jews, the Catholics, the mentally ill, the gay, the straight, the gypsies, all those who perished unjustly, and those who continue to perish unjustly all over the world simply for their difference. We ask healing, healing on the countries, healing upon the leaders, healing upon the survivors, for peace, for very simple peace. May it be so. Amen. Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you hold in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend.
Good morning. First off, thank you for having me here, have the opportunity to share the pulpit this morning, swap it with Reverend Melissa. So I'm very thankful for being here. I actually grew up in Kent, so coming back to town is always fun for me. I'm going to play a scenario for you, and you can try it on and see if it sounds like something familiar to you. Perhaps you got an evaluation from a boss, and the boss told you maybe 37 things that you do really awesomely, and one thing that could be an opportunity for growth. And what do maybe you focus on for the whole rest of the day and the night and the next day? Do we remind ourselves of those 37 things, or do we focus on that one thing that was an opportunity for growth? Wholehearted Living, the title of the service this morning, is based on the work of Dr. Brené Brown, who's a writer and research professor at the University of Houston at their Graduate School of Social Work. She's a researcher in the field of social work. She started out researching. She was very good at that, enjoyed the kind of black and whiteness of research. her ability to quantify things, analyze them. She didn't really have to do the messy part of social work, and that pleased her. It appealed to her. And during the course of her studies and her research, she was looking at connections, the connections we have that we share with each other. And it got messier than she planned in the process. She found out that when she asked people about love, they told her instead about heartbreak. When she asked people about belonging, they'd tell her about their most excruciating experience of being excluded. And when she asked people about their connection, stories they told were about disconnection. This turned into her 6-year study. It wasn't the direction she had thought it was going to go. It became life-changing for her because it took her personally places she hadn't planned on going, but which she was very thankful to have found along the way. Shame wasn't what she had set out to look at. She was set out to look at connections. And shame, she found out, wasn't a place that very many people want to look at. She recites a lot of anecdotes in 2 of her books that I have and that I've had the pleasure of going through. She tells about people's discomfort with even hearing the title shame. Particularly, she was coming to speak at something at Case Western University some years back. She had a passenger next to her, a gal who they chatted freely and comfortably until it got along to the topic of what she was actually coming to speak about at Case Western. And when Dr. Brené Brown told her that it was about shame, her passenger, her fellow passenger with whom she thought they felt a connection, suddenly feigned sleep, even to the point of pretending to snore while her foot tapped. So I purposely didn't include shame in the title of it. One, because it's not the whole focus of it. The focus is of how we process through what might be shameful for us to live with a whole heart, in a wholehearted way. But how eager might you have been to show up for the service if I had included the word shame in the title? Might you have felt you wanted to listen to that service? I don't know. Sometimes people recoil, whether they know shame or not. We often don't just want to talk about it. It's so powerful of an emotion that we often feel shame just by talking about it. So, is shame a four-letter word? Speaking of four-letter words, yes, it has 5 letters, doesn't it? Your math is better than mine, clearly. In February, my home congregation in Canton performed the Vagina Monologues. Now, I confess, as a female who came of age in the 70s, the Vagina Monologues was definitely on my radar. But I also confess, in the spirit of truthfulness and integrity, that I had not gone out of my way to seek out a performance of the Vagina Monologues, because it sounded a little more in your face than what I thought I would be comfortable with. So lo and behold, we had a strong group of women who really thought we should do it. February is the month to do it, is when typically it's done. For those of you who might not be aware of it, it's a very candid, very, what adjectives might I use to describe it?
Body funny.
Body funny, raunchy. Hilarious, touching, very moving series of monologues that have been put together and presented for the purpose of doing away with violence, particularly violence against women and children. So there was one particular monologue. Fortunately, I wasn't asked to do that one. But what I learned about it was, I learned a lot from doing the whole Vagina Monologues. I could do a whole series on, a whole service on that. But one thing that I came away with was, there was one monologue that was a 4-letter word that deals with a most private part of a female that I've always heard used in a very derogatory way. And so therefore, I've always been uncomfortable with that word. I do my fair share of cussing, but that's not a word that I would ever use to cuss. But in the monologue about that one, the gal who did it for us, Maya, in it she waxed passionately, poetically, and lovingly about this part of her anatomy. And as we went through rehearsals and as we went through different parts of the process before performance, I learned a lesson. I learned a lesson that what we own in the very process and act of owning it can no longer be used in a hurtful way, in a painful way. We can hold it and own it in a different way. Whatever significance I had that was derogatory that I had attached to that was kind of dissolved by the way in which she embraced that monologue, particularly the passage. She even took the sting out of the sharpness of the word itself. To me, it's one of those that just has a... So what we own loses its power over us by owning it. So as Dr. Brown studied shame, it became really her focus. She ultimately spent the 6 years researching. She came up with several things. One, shame, we all have it. Like it or not, it's universal, and it's one of the most primitive human emotions that we can experience. She says that the only people who don't experience shame lack the capacity for empathy and human connection. Two, we're all afraid to talk about shame. And three, the less we talk about it, the more control it has over our lives. She describes shame as basically the fear of being unlovable, the total opposite of owning our story and feeling worthy. She describes it as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Shame keeps worthiness away by convincing us that owning our stories will lead to people thinking less of us. Shame is all about fear. We're afraid that people won't like us if they know the truth about who we are, where we come from, what we believe, how much we might be struggling, or believe it or not, how wonderful we are when soaring. Because sometimes it's just as hard to own our strengths as our struggles. Now, we might want to believe that shame is reserved for the folks who've survived terrible traumas, but no, not so. Shame is something that we all experience, a universal emotion, a silent epidemic. And while it feels as if shame hides in our darkest corners, it does way more than that. It actually tends to lurk in all the familiar places, including our appearance and body image, our family and parenting, money and work, health, addiction, sex, aging, and even religion. To feel shame is to be human. The stories of our struggles are difficult for everyone to own. And if we've worked hard to make sure everything looks just right on the outside, the stakes can be high when it comes to truth-telling. Dr. Brown says, this is why shame loves perfectionists. It's so easy to keep us quiet. In addition to the fear of disappointing people or pushing them away with our stories, we're also afraid that if we tell our stories, the weight of a single experience will collapse upon us. There's a real fear that we can be buried or defined by an experience that in reality is only a sliver of who we are. She tells this story at one of her anecdotes is about a woman who told a neighbor after they'd been established and close friends for a long time, their children played together. She happened to mention in passing, she said, I'm a recovering alcoholic. She said, I've been in recovery for like 15 years or something. And the lady was supportive to a point. After which the lady said to her, the lady then didn't really want their children to hang out anymore. The less we understand shame and how it affects our feelings, our thoughts, and our behaviors, the more power it exerts over our lives. If we can find the courage to talk about shame and the compassion to listen, we can change how we live, how we love, how we parent, work, and build relationships. Shame is becoming an increasingly divisive and destructive part of our culture. To varying degrees, we all know the struggle to feel comfortable. We all struggle with feelings of not being good enough, not having enough, not belonging enough. We live in a culture that promotes being rich, smart, and thin as equated with being good, sexy, attractive, or successful. We grew up with pictures in our minds of what we want everything to look like, some personal version of the white picket fence story. When I first happened on Dr. Brown's work on TED-TED, you guys, if you ever go to that website or if you have a phone application for it, they have some videos and things on there and you can hear. And I found her to be, as you would as well, to be very warm and humorous. She could do stand-up. She's really funny. She's very honest, forthright, and she shows a lot of insight. I was really moved by what she had to say. Because I don't know that I had a dream of the picket fence exactly, but I do know that there are quite a few things in my life that wouldn't have been in the script that I might have written. Shame was a significant part of my life for many years, based on things that happened to me. Some I didn't share for a very long time. Some I've still only shared with a few people outside of sharing them from the pulpit, which makes a difference. I was the victim of a serious assault when I was 20. I married a man. My goal was always to marry a man whose parents weren't divorced, thinking that made him a better prospect. Instead, I married a man who was divorced, had custody of three children. I have a son now, so they're grown, they're adults. I have a son who's 17. I had miscarriages. Divorced 8 years ago. We had extreme financial difficulties at the end of the divorce, which were very shameful for me. We've all had lots of things. I worked hard during that time to keep up appearances. There was a time when I was pregnant that I was working part-time. My husband quit working totally within less than 3 years within a 15-year marriage. He quit working. He had some health things. I don't know that they were extensive enough. At this point, he's not workable. He's not employable. But at that point, I don't know that he needed to be done working totally. I don't think he did, truthfully. We were on food stamps at that time. Actually, the only reason that we did was because I felt like I needed insurance backup in the event of anything catastrophic. I was 40 and pregnant and had some risks based on age and based on some other things. And I was terrified that whatever my insurance wouldn't pay, that I would still be paying the rest of my life in catastrophic insurance bills. So I had to go through all that rigmarole to get that. We did the food stamps, which we sorely needed. Here I was. Now you have to understand, I'm a lifelong social worker who has been supportive and respected people of any kind of needs my whole life and supported them and guided them and assisted them, facilitated getting things that they deserved, needed services. And here I was, a bit of a hypocrite, that I was taking my food stamps to the grocery store at midnight so I didn't run into anyone I knew. As hypocritical as that might be. So Dr. Brown came to understand shame. She's talked to thousands of people, listened to their stories, hundreds of long interviews, focus groups. She was deluged with things that people sent her. And what she ultimately found out in the shame was she found that there were two groups of people among those she had spoken with. There was one group who had a real sense of worthiness, strong sense of being loved and belonging. And the second group was those who struggled for it, always wondering if they were good enough. Now, the only thing that separated the people that had a strong sense of love and belonging is that sense of worthiness. They believed that they were worthy of love and belonging. So she looked at what they had in common, and she called it wholehearted, was the way in which they approached things. She looked to see what the pattern was among those. And the first thing she found was that they had a sense of courage. And she defines courage from the traditional definition of courage from the Latin, meaning heart, which means originally to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And the folks, those folks that she talked to that felt worthy, they simply had the courage to be imperfect. The second of the series of three C's, courage, the second is compassion. They had the compassion to be kind to themselves first and then to others, because we know you can't be compassionate for others if you can't treat yourself kindly. And the third of the C's was connection. As a result of authenticity, they were willing to let go of who they thought they should be in order to be who simply they were. Because you can't have connection without being who you are. They also fully embraced vulnerability. They believed that what made them vulnerable made them beautiful, their true colors. They didn't talk about vulnerability being comfortable, nor did they really talk about it being excruciating. They just talked about it being necessary. They talked about the willingness to say, I love you, first. The willingness to do something without guarantees. To breathe through waiting for the doctor to call after your test. To invest in a relationship that may or may not work out. They thought that was fundamental. They chose to not selectively numb their emotions. They stayed open to them. So what Dr. Brown advises is that we have to let ourselves be seen deeply and vulnerably, to love with our whole hearts even without guarantee, to practice gratitude and joy in the moments of terror, when we're wondering, can I love this much? Can I believe in this passionately? Can I be this fierce about this? Just to be able to stop and say, I am just so grateful because to feel this vulnerable means that I am alive. And the last is to believe that we're enough. Because she says that when we believe that we're enough, we stop screaming and start listening. We're kinder and gentler to the people around us, and we're kinder and gentler to ourselves. This past year, I had occasion to accompany a girlfriend whose niece, as a freshman, is playing basketball, and she's actually been invited some of the time to play with the varsity team. She had a coach along the way that gave the team very good advice. He told the team to trust their stuff. Whatever it is that we have, all of us, if we can trust it for what it is for us, that it's enough for us, that it's enough for each other, and that we can accept each other's stuff as well. Wholehearted living is a process, a journey of a lifetime, engaging in our lives from a place of worthiness, cultivating the courage,
the compassion and the connection to wake up in the morning and think, no matter what gets done and how much is left undone, I am enough. It's going to bed at night thinking, yes, I'm imperfect and vulnerable and sometimes afraid. But that doesn't change the truth that I am also brave and worthy of love and belonging. My son's doctor, he's a new doctor for some meds he's on, including ADD meds. His doctor framed in a way that I found to be very attractive how he described the use of medications. And I've made analogies myself, talking to people. I've heard countless analogies, but I hadn't heard this one, and I liked it. He compared needing medication as needing eyeglasses. He said, we have vision. We're blessed with vision. We just need the medication like we need our glasses to help us focus. I liked that perspective. It took the thing that we often direct as shame or blame. It took that away. It eliminated that. So the message I want to leave you with this morning is, may we live wholeheartedly. May we keep our focus not on shame, but on all that is beautiful in our lives. So may it be. May we know that owning our story and loving ourselves is the bravest thing that we will ever do. May we support and honor ourselves and each other. Go in peace and love and courage. Amen. Blessed be.